Hello, everybody. Welcome to a new episode of The Dissenter. I'm your host, as always, Ricardo Lopes, and today I'm joined by Dr. William Harris. He is Professor Emeritus of Anatomy at Cambridge University and Fellow of Clare College, Cambridge. And today we're going to talk about his book, Zero to Birth, How the Human Brain is Built. So, Dr. Harris, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to have you on.
Thank you very much. It's going to be fun to talk to you.
So, could you tell us first what is basically the premise of your book? I mean, why did you write it, and what would you say is the main topic you explore there?
The reason I wrote the book is because I spent a career studying the development of brains, mostly in experimental animals like flies and fish and frogs. And when I retired, I realized that although there were textbooks on the subject, there wasn't much in the way of popular books on how the brain develops. What we teach in universities hasn't been made accessible to the public. So I wanted to try to do that in a way that was entertaining and educational, and a lot of people could read it.
Mm-hmm. Evolutionarily speaking, how old is the brain?
Brains seem to start at the very beginning of animal life, 600 million years ago, or 500 million years ago, when the first multicellular animals arose. Some of those multicellular animals had collections of cells that you could call neurons. And when they were organized near the front of the animal, we called them the brain. In the head region, we called them the brain. Before that, there were single-celled creatures, protozoans, and they had components, they had genes that were used in the first multicellular animals in the early nervous systems of those animals.
Since in the book you focus a lot on the development of the brain, and more so of the human brain, when exactly does this development start during intrauterine life?
Well, in general, we say that the origins of the brain in a developing vertebrate embryo, such as a human, start at about the time of gastrulation, which is at about 3 weeks post-conception, or 3 weeks post-fertilization. So it's at that stage when a ball of cells, these cells being all, none of them having any particular function yet, some of the cells get specialized and become the founders of different tissues. So the founders of the muscle system, the founders of the intestinal system, or the gastrointestinal system, and the founders of the nervous system, they arise at about that time in development. Before that stage, all the cells could do all of those things. After that stage, they become committed to make particular types of tissues or organs.
Mm-hmm. And what are the cells that give rise to neurons, and how do they differentiate into neurons?
The cells that give rise to neurons are called neural stem cells. And they're the ones that arise at this stage, gastrulation, which in humans happens in about 3 weeks. These are dividing cells. They are not neurons yet. They're the great, great grandparents of the neurons, the Adams and Eves of our brains. And they divide and divide and divide until there's enough of them. And then some of them stop dividing. And when they divide for the last time, they produce, instead of more neural stem cells, they produce neurons. The first neurons that arise probably at about at the end of the first trimester.
Mm-hmm. And how does the brain then get organized into different regions? How does that happen?
Well, an embryo has these axes, you could say, like a, when it's even when it's a ball of cells, it has a north pole and a south pole and an east and a west. Or we say the dorsal and the ventral and the right side and the left side. There's also an inside out. So these axes are already there. And when an embryo starts growing, it elongates in the front to back direction. So we have a front and a back and a dorsal and a ventral, or a back and a belly and a left and a right and an inside and an outside. And there are signals in the embryo, little molecules that are telling the cells where they are on all these axes. So I'm at, you know, this particular coordinate. And if you're at that particular coordinate, then you're going to become that part of the brain if you're part of the nervous system.
Is the idea that ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny right when it comes to brain development? That is it the case that the way brains develop in particular organisms sort of recapitulate how they evolved?
In a sense, yes, but the statement ontogeny recapitulates phylogeny was made by a German scientist named Haeckel, and I think in the 1800s sometime, and that detailed conception is wrong. What he was meaning was that an organism that is more advanced develops from the adult form of a less advanced organism and adds something else to it. We know that changes in the way evolution works can happen at any stage of development. So it doesn't always have to be an addition to the last stage of your evolutionary ancestor. It could be an addition to an intermediate stage. What we do find, though, is that all brains and all vertebrates have a stage at which they look most similar to each other. And that's called what we call the phylotypic stage, when the embryos of all these different animals, like a chick or a turtle or a lizard or a human, they look pretty similar and their brains look fairly similar. So this common embryological state happens fairly early on. And then as the embryo progresses, the brains become more and more different between these different vertebrates.
Is there any particular reason why the brain is located in the head? Could it have been in some other place?
I think so. In an octopus, they say that, you know, there are brains, peripheral brains, as well as a central brain. There is a big central brain in an octopus, but there are peripheral brains. There are discussions about dinosaurs, whether they had a big mass of neurons in the thoracic region. Insects have a brain, of course, and they have, but also they have a thoracic ganglion, which has a lot of processing power. And we have a lot of processing power in our spinal cord. But when the animals that have bilateral symmetry, like us, where the left and the right sides are similar, worms also are like that. A lot of animals, except for jellyfish and things like that, have this bilateral symmetry, and they have a front end, and they go forward in that direction. And that we call that the front end. And if you want to be aware of your surroundings and where you're going into, it seems that in evolution, organisms move sensory apparatus, eyes, smell, taste, towards the front end. So they did a lot of sensory processing at the front end, and that's where they accumulated processing power, neurons, to evaluate those sensory inputs. And that became known as the brain, that collection of neurons that evaluates all the sensory inputs and sent signals out to motor command centers.
Is neurodevelopment genetically determined?
Largely, yes. If you have an egg that has a human genome in it and let it develop, it will make a human embryo with a human brain. If you have an egg with a mouse genome in it, it will go through development and make a mouse with a mouse brain. So the instructions for making a brain are largely in the genes that are in the genome, in all the genes. But environment can influence and does influence the way the brain develops. So it isn't all in the genes. Bad nutrition or good nutrition has an effect on the way the brain develops. Whether a mother is exposed to smoke or alcohol or drugs affects the way the brain develops. What hormones are circulating affects the way the brain develops. So, and at a cellular level, a cell sees signals in its surround. So even though it may have the genes to do one thing, if it gets a signal to do something else, it may do something else. In addition to the role of the environment and the role of genes, there is a role of chance or probability, because sometimes things go one way and sometimes things go another way, even though it's in the same environment with the same genome. There's a bit of unpredictability in the way that cells behave, that neural stem cells behave.
So how do you look at the interplay between different, I guess we could say, physiological factors that play a role in how the brain differentiates in terms of regions and so on? Because, for example, we have different biochemicals, membrane receptors, transcription factors, activation and deactivation of different genes. So, I mean, there seems to be lots of complexity here. How do you look at how those different things relate to one another?
Bit by bit, tiny bit by tiny bit. There are a lot of developmental neurobiologists out there in the world, in laboratories and scientific institutions, universities throughout the world, and many of them, like myself, investigated a small issue, one small issue at a time. For me, I was interested in, for a lot of my life, how the retina of a fish develops. And learning from that, if some of those lessons were the same in other animals, mammals, for example, or humans. And there is a lot of learning that happens that way. You investigate something in one animal and you find it's the same or different in another animal. Often it's the same at the early stages for the reasons we discussed before. So the brain is a very, very complicated object with billions, 100 billion neurons, each making 1,000 or so connections. And that has to be done with great precision. And there are, if you had a manual to make the brain, if you could read the genome and understand how that genome translates into me, there'd be thousands and thousands and thousands of small steps. And each one has to be investigated bit by bit.
So just to take an example, there's variation between individuals when it comes to the shape and size of different cortical areas of the brain. What factors play a role there, for example?
Okay, so imagine that you're dividing up a territory, like a country, and you have to draw border lines between this one country and the next country. And what are the mechanisms that you use to draw border lines? Well, what are the mechanisms that the brain uses to draw a border line? They may sense a chemical. If it's above a certain threshold, It will be in one country. If it's below a certain threshold, it will be in another country. In your brain and my brain, we have these gradients of these chemicals with thresholds. In your brain and my brain, it might not have been exactly the same, either because you made a little bit more of it, or I made a little bit less of it, or it, you know, there's a part of the embryo which makes this chemical, and there's another part of the brain which destroys this chemical, so you might have a gradient of it. And depending on how that works in your brain and my brain, we'll probably draw the borderline at slightly different places.
Right. And generally speaking, during gestation, how do neural stem cells divide and proliferate?
How do they divide and proliferate? So at the beginning of brain formation, when we have a population, the early population of neural stem cells, mm-hmm. all of those cells are dividing. So one cell makes two cells, two make four make eight, and it goes growing exponentially. At some point, probably because largely an intrinsic mechanism, the cell knows that it's a human neural stem cell. It knows, I've done enough of this symmetrical division. I've made enough neural stem cells. And now some of these neural stem cells, they divide in a different way. We call it an asymmetric division, where one daughter of this division stays as a neural stem cell, and the other daughter differentiates into a neuron. And then the growth of the brain becomes more linear, not so exponential, because you're just increasing one at a time. And then near the end of embryonic development, near birth, most of the stem cells that are left, they divide to produce two neurons, and there are no more stem cells left. So it goes from producing two neural stem cells to producing one neural stem cell to producing no neural stem cells. And all the neural stem cells get used up, and your brain becomes populated with neurons.
Mm-hmm. So after birth, the brain still grows and develops. Is there anything special that characterizes brain growth postnatally?
Yes, clearly a baby is born with a much smaller head than it has as an adult, and its brain is only about a third of the size of the brain that it will have, that he or she will have as an adult. Most of that growth is due to the continued production of the support cells of the brain, the glial cells. Some people will criticize me for calling them support cells because they do very important jobs in the brain. But they don't process information quite the same way as neurons do. Neurons are the computers of the brain. But there are as many glial cells as there are neurons. And the other important thing is that neurons, when they're first born, are small. And as the animal or the human grows, the neurons also grow, so they become bigger as well.
And since you mentioned, before we move on to other topics, since you mentioned glial cells, could you tell us a little bit about some of the main functions of them?
Yes. Well, we think there's two main classes of glial cells in your brain. Ones are called oligodendrocytes, and they wrap around the axons of neurons. The axons are the wires that come out of, or the processes that come out of neurons that are electrically active, and they send signals from one neuron to the next neuron, or one neuron to a muscle cell, for example. So these long wires, electrically active wires, get coated in a fatty membrane sheath provided by oligodendrocytes, this form of glia. That's the white matter of the brain, the wrappings around all these axons. The other main type of glia in the brain are called astrocytes. And astrocytes provide nutrition for neurons. They communicate with the blood and they bring nutrients into the brain. They help the neurons maintain the right ionic environment around them so that they work well. They help in the formation of connections between neurons. They help make synapses and do a variety of other functions.
Mm-hmm.
There is one other type of neuron in the brain called microglia, which are like the white blood cells of the brain that are part of the immune system of the brain, you could say.
Mm-hmm. Earlier, when we talked about neurodevelopment and I mentioned some of the variables, the factors that play a role there, I mean, since there are so many that influence neural proliferation, how is it that from such an predictable patterns of proliferation, we get brains of the right size and proportion?
Yeah, that's a fascinating question. And the way I think about it is to compare it to the law of large numbers. Even though there's an unpredictability when you flip a coin, whether it will be heads or tails, if you do it 10,000 times, you're likely to get approximately 5,000 heads and approximately 5,000 tails, plus or minus 100 or so. So if we think about the way the unpredictability of neurons in that way, and experimental evidence suggests that there is that kind of stochasticity or unpredictability to it, then even though you and I might not have exactly the same number of neurons, we'll have approximately the same number of neurons. And that's also true for each type of neuron in our brain. So your eyes and my eyes might not have exactly the same number of cells in them, but we have approximately the same number. And you have approximately the same number of, you know, red cones, so you can see the red light as I do, if you're not colorblind, even though we might not have exactly the same ones in the same regions. So you and I might not see same colors exactly the same way, but almost the same way.
Mm-hmm. Do we know if neurons can regenerate?
Yes, neurons can regenerate, but it depends on the stage of the animal and what animal it is. So if you're a flatworm, which you're not, then you can regenerate your whole brain. And if you're a frog, a young frog, and I remove a little bit of your brain, then that can be regenerated too. Once you're an adult frog, it's much harder to do. And in mammals, you know, if you kill some cells in an adult human, they don't regenerate. They don't make new neurons to replace the old ones. But maybe in a very young embryo, they would. But I'm talking in utero. By the time a baby is born, it's lost most of the capacity to regenerate those neurons because the neural stem cells have been used up. So new neurons generally come from neural stem cells that still have the capacity to divide. But adult neurons don't have that capacity. There's another aspect of regeneration that you might want to talk about. That is, if you cut the axon of a neuron, which happens sometimes in, say, in an automobile accident or a sporting accident where someone's neck is crunched and they lose the ability to move below the lesion, that is not necessarily killing the neurons above where the lesion, but the axons that were going down from the brain to tell, give instructions to the motor neurons in the spinal neuron, spinal cord, those axons have been cut. And generally, they don't regenerate very well either in humans, but they do much better in fish, for example. We don't quite know why mammals have lost this ability to regenerate well, but lots of people are trying to study it and find ways to make regeneration of that kind better.
As humans, when we reach adulthood, do we still have any neural stem cells at all?
There is a debate about that. Some people say yes, some people say no. The people who say yes say there's probably some in a region of the brain called the hippocampus. Mm-hmm. This is a region in the forebrain which is involved in memory formation. And I think the most reliable evidence suggests that there is new neuron production in the hippocampus throughout life, although there's more in early years, less in later years. But if you're laying down new memories, young neurons are very plastic. They can make and change their connections. So it might be useful to have some young neurons in a place where you're making new memories. The other place where we know we make new neurons is in the olfactory epithelium. It's not really part of the brain, but it's a sensory apparatus at the back of your nose that smells and sends the signals into the brain. So we make new olfactory receptors as well. And there is some new evidence emerging all the time about potential neural stem cells hidden away in the cortex. But we know that if you damage the cortex, it's known for hundreds of years that if you damage the cortex, it just does not renew itself.
Mm-hmm. And how do neurons become specific types of neurons and acquire particular functions?
Yes. Well, the brain is really interesting in this regard. I always found the brain really fascinating in this regard because it's so different from other tissues in that it has so many different, more different types of cells. The retina, which I studied, there's probably 100 or more different types of neurons in the retina. You already know that we have red cones, blue cones, green cones, and they're responsible for color vision. And we also have rods, which are responsible for black and white vision. So that's four types of photoreceptors. And connected to those four photoreceptor types are about 20 different types of what are called bipolar cells and horizontal cells. And connected to those bipolar cells and horizontal cells, there's about 30 or 40 or 50 different types of amacrine cells and a similar number of different types of retinal ganglion cells, all processing different types of visual information, and they send it into the brain. So in each area of the brain, there's a myriad of different cell types, each doing a different type of computation on the signals that are coming in and sending out signals that are going out to different regions of the brain so that those regions can do computations. The tissue that's most similar in terms of diversity may be the immune system, where there's lots of different types of white blood cells and many different types of antibody-producing cells. But I don't think it holds much comparison to the brain. Some people say that every neuron in your brain, and it is true, every neuron in your brain is slightly chemically different from every other neuron and has its own specific anatomy, so it can do its own specific job in the little office that it's in, you know, getting this kind of information and sending it out to who it talks to. Mm-hmm. And how does that happen? Yeah, is that what you want to know? That's what I wanted to know. How does that happen? And it's largely unknown, but people are investigating it furiously. But if there are, say, 10,000 different types of neurons in the brain, It's going to take many, many years before we understand how all those different cell types arise. But what we know is generally that if you're born in a particular part of the brain, if you're a neuron that's born in a particular part of the brain, your fate will already be limited to neurons that are born in that place. So there's successive limitations. If you're born in a place, if you're born at a particular time, if you're born third in a lineage, not the first son, not the second son, but the third son, that may affect your fate. What signals you're exposed to when you're born will affect your fate, and a little bit of randomness again. So we know those are the general ways that neurons get their fate. It's just like people get their different jobs, you know, depending on where you were, what your dad did, and those kind of things that can affect who you turn into.
Mm-hmm. We're talking about brain development here, and of course, when it comes to all questions related to development, people get into discussions surrounding nature and nurture, and we've already talked a little bit about that when I asked you earlier if neurodevelopment is genetically determined or not. But I would like to ask you now about another thing. How much of a role would you say chance plays in brain development?
When you say how much, that is a pretty hard question to answer. What people tend to do is they say, how much can we ascribe to heritability? So you may take a factor, maybe it's a component of personality, and you say, how much is, you know, heritable? And it's not very heritable, maybe less than half. But identical twins tend to have more similar personality than non-identical twins. So there is a bit of heritability to it, even to identical twins raised apart. But it's still not very high. In fact, identical twins, probably the thing that's most different about them is their personality. So there's something else besides genetics.
Mm-hmm.
That could be environment. It could be that these identical twins, even though they were raised in the same womb, had slightly different environments. They had different umbilical cords. They may have been exposed slightly differently in the womb to things. And then there's chance. So people then say, okay, well, here's the part that's heritable, maybe 30% heritable. And the other, you know, we know that the environment plays a certain role, but it can't account for all everything else. And that everything else might be chance. But the other way I like to think about it is that it's always an interplay. You always have the genes working. They're always working in an environment. And there's chance is always playing a role too. And it's really hard to separate them and say, you know, this part is due to chance, this part is due to the environment, this part, because they're always interacting in some way.
Mm-hmm. If no two human brains are alike, what kind of implications does that have? For instance, does it mean that there are no two people that experience reality exactly the same way?
Absolutely. No two people have exactly the same face. No two people have exactly the same fingerprints. No two people have exactly the same brain. Everybody has their own individual experience. You're born, your brain is still developing. It's the neurons are there, and they've made preliminary connections, but these connections are getting refined by experience. And if no two people have the same experience, they're not going to have the same connectivity in their brain exactly as each other. And that means the memories that are set off by particular experiences will be different in two people. It's impossible to imagine two people experiencing things in exactly the same way. And I guess that means that, you know, you have to respect every other person that you can communicate with in some way because of their unique experience and vision and capacity, mental capacity.
Mm-hmm. One aspect of brain development we haven't touched on yet is how does the brain get wired up? So how does it get there?
Yeah. Well, that was a question I was I did a lot of research on during my career. And it was when I first started back in the 1970s, a question that people didn't really have much of an idea about. Work in many labs, not mostly my lab, but many labs, found some of the secrets to wiring up the brain. Mm-hmm. And what we focused on in all those years has been how axons, the neurons, travel in the brain to connect to other neurons. And the example that I used was the cells in the eye, the retinal ganglion cells in the eye, grow out of the eye along the optic nerve into the brain and connect with particular targets in the brain, in the midbrain. But other people were working on, you know, insects, how motor neurons got to their muscle cells, or how sensory neurons got into the brain, or how neurons within the brain made connections with other brains, sometimes distant. So guidance, navigation of axons. It was already known that at the end of a growing axon, there was a structure called a growth cone, which is an expansion at the end of the axon, was discovered by Ramon y Cajal in the 1800s. And then Ross Harrison found that it was a very dynamic structure in the early 1900s, looking at growth cones under the microscope. And they look like a hand with fingers that are probing and reaching out in all directions. And they can pull in one direction or they can pull in another direction, depending on which fingers are pulling the hardest. And they're growing, and the axon is lengthening behind them as they navigate. And they're paying attention to these guidance factors, molecular guidance factors. So they may grow along and they see something that is repulsive and they'll turn away from it, or they'll sense something that's attractive and they'll turn towards it. And these attractive and repulsive guidance factors in the embryonic brain are in a pattern in the brain that different axons can read in different ways. So what's attractive to one axon may be repulsive. So these two axons could be going to different targets, reading the same cues, like we read a map going to a different city, and somebody else may be reading the same map and going in a different direction.
Mm-hmm. So when axons are guided in their growth and positioning and they reach other neurons, how are synapses established?
Yes. Well, once axons have been guided and get to their final area, mm-hmm. they come into a part of the nervous system or a part of the muscle system where there are many possible synaptic partners. Mm-hmm. But some of them are better than others for these particular neurons. For instance, you may go to a dance and there are lots of eligible partners for you, but you home in on certain ones because they seem more perfect for you. The same way that neurons seem to know that neurons and their partners seem to know that they're meant for each other in some way. And what we understand now is that they tend to have these molecules on their surface, of the surface membranes. They're transmembrane molecules that are called adhesion molecules, cell adhesion molecules. And if you and I express the same cell adhesion molecule that likes to bind to itself, then we'll be sticking to each other. And if two neurons are expressing several cell adhesion molecules that are matched, then they'll be well matched to stick to each other. And the more matching you have, the more likely they are to stick to each other. So now you imagine a field of neurons, each one of which slightly different levels of this combination of cell adhesion molecules, and a target field of neurons with slightly different things. And then the neurons and their target neurons match up based on optimal matching. So that is basically the way it's done initially, and then things are fine-tuned by experience.
Okay, and when synapses are established, how do they work?
So once two neurons recognize that they're meant for each other and want to make a synapse, they have to develop a synapse. At the end of the axon, which is the signaling component of this synapse, you start to accumulate vesicles. Usually it's a chemical synapse. And in these little vesicles at the axon, they're filled with neurotransmitters, like glutamate or GABA, gamma aminobutyric acid, or serotonin, or dopamine, or some of these famous neurotransmitters that people know about, acetylcholine. And those vesicles are released onto the postsynaptic neuron, the receiving neuron, onto the dendrite of the receiving neuron, which has receptors for those neurotransmitters. So to make a synapse, you have to make a specialized presynaptic structure for releasing the vesicles and a specialized postsynaptic structure for receiving those chemicals and turning that reception into an electrical signal. So the electrical signal comes down, it stimulates through a lot of interesting molecules, the release of neurotransmitter, the release of these vesicles, and the postsynaptic neuron receives that neurotransmitter with neurotransmitter receptor, and it opens ion channels that change the membrane voltage of the postsynaptic cell, which leads to an electric signal in the postsynaptic cell.
So when neurons establish synapses between one another, do they stay the same across the lifespan of the individual, or is it that they can weaken, strengthen, break up and then perhaps establish synapses with other neurons? Do those things happen?
Yes, those things definitely happen. And that's why, you know, if you read my book and you learn something, something will have changed in your brain. And what will have changed in your brain is some synapses will be strengthened and others weakened. Maybe some new connections will be made. In early life, you lay down most of the connections, and the brain is very plastic, and its connections are being refined dramatically. Mostly it's due to synaptic loss, because early in life you make too many connections, and to make a more efficient brain you have to get rid of some of those. So many connections are lost. Once that happens, then during adult life, it's more likely that synapses get strengthened and weakened. And that, because of that, connectivity patterns change in the brain. So if you weaken the connection from A to B and strengthen the connection from A to C, the pathway may now go from A to C. And so you can change the connectivity, basic connectivity of the brain, not by actually making new synapses, but by strengthening or weakening some. That's not to say that you don't lose synapses altogether or gain some new synapses. And as you get older and older, that process becomes a little bit harder. So older people like myself get more set in their ways, harder to learn new things.
So what you've just mentioned involves what is called neuron pruning, right?
Neuron pruning and neuron plasticity.
Mm-hmm. Right. Are there critical periods in brain development? Can we talk about that?
Absolutely. If you are, for example, the prime example of critical period comes from the work of David Hubel and Torsten Wiesel. And what they did was to deprive the visual system of vision through one eye for a time. They used kittens for these experiments, closing one eye for a period in the first 3 months of the life of a kitten. If the eye is closed, nothing bad happens to the eye. The retina is still okay. And then if you open the eye and ask the kitten to see through that eye, it behaves as if it's blind. And if you look into the visual cortex in the brain of that cat, and you try to record activity from the deprived eye, you find you can't really find much. All the activity in the brain is coming through the eye that was left open and can see. Now, if you do the same experiment on an adult cat and even close an eye for a year and then reopen it, that eye can still see. And there's no loss of vision. Vision comes back immediately. So it's just in this very early period. Similarly, say in humans that are blind from birth, if you can restore their sight late as adults, they don't see very well. Their visual cortex is now used probably for other things more, and it's too late to restore vision. But if an adult goes blind and stays blind for 10 years, and then you then sight is restored, he can see well, or she can see well again. So it's quite interesting. Humans have this critical period for vision. They also appear to have a critical period for language learning, because it's easy to learn a language when you're a wee kid. But as an adult, it's much harder to learn a second language. Mm-hmm. And it's thought that there's critical periods for many aspects of our brain development.
Talking about neuroplasticity, what are the limits of it? Because I'm asking you this because sometimes we hear and read people who publish popular books, not necessarily specialists, neuroscientists in this case, but talking about neuroplasticity, and sometimes it seems that they exaggerate it, and sometimes it even seems that it's limitless, but it's not really, right?
I agree with you. It's not really. Part of the reason I wrote this book is because of that misconception that everybody is born with the same brain with limitless possibilities. I don't think that's true. Everybody is born with a particular brain with, you know, innumerable possibilities, but not limitless possibilities. So because we're structured in certain ways, we can do things. You can't become, for example, You're not likely to become a great basketball star if you're only 4 feet tall. I'm not saying that you can compare the brain to that way, but what I'm saying is that there are, if the thing we talked about earlier is, say you were born with a lot of visual area compared to me, you might turn out to be someone who can visualize things well or paint well or something like that, and I might not be able to do that. So I think the differences between our brains mean that we have different capabilities. And they're not, none of them are limitless, I don't think. Mm-hmm. Because we're wired up in a particular way, we can change a certain amount, but we can't change totally.
Mm-hmm. Right.
We have personalities that we're almost born with, we're temperaments, we call them in little kids. And although you can change that a little bit, you can't change it absolutely. You can't deny who you are, really.
Mm-hmm. Evolutionarily speaking, is there anything special about the human brain?
Absolutely. Evolutionarily speaking, there's something special about every brain. The ant's brain is specialized for ant life, and a human brain is specialized for human life. So, yes, because we're different animals, we have a different brain, just like we have different hands, different, everything about us is slightly different than our closest ancestors. Our closest current relatives are chimpanzees, and we have different brains than them. Our brains are four times as big as a chimpanzee brain. We have many more cortical areas, although chimpanzee probably has hundreds of cortical areas, and we have 180 cortical areas. They might not have quite that many, but ours, you know, we have different sizes of cortical areas. Our midbrain and hindbrain and spinal cord is not so different than a chimpanzee's, but our cortex is quite different, bigger and with more areas.
Mm-hmm. So there's one last topic that I would like to ask you about, having to do with brain asymmetry. So why is it that brains are not, at least in humans, are not exactly symmetrical, and there are certain areas and functions that seem to be lateralized?
Yes, particularly famous is the area that has to do with the areas that have to do with language. Mm-hmm. Most people have a dominant left side for language. There is an area called Broca's area, which is much larger in humans than it is in chimpanzees. So that's a specialized area in humans. The chimpanzees have one, but it's not as big. And Broca's area is important for making speech. And it's mostly on the left side, but in some people it's on the right side. And in some people it's more evenly spread. As humans and advanced primates develop more and more cortical areas, there might not have been, I'm just speculating here, so this is speculating. There might have been a reason to try to pack in a different area, but, you know, because we have two of something, one on the right side, one on the left side, maybe you could afford to make the one on the right side slightly different than the one on the left side, so it processes slightly different information. That's often the way things happen in genetic development. You duplicate a gene, but you don't need two genes that do exactly the same thing. So one becomes slightly specialized and does something slightly different. So instead of having two same areas on both sides, you make one do something slightly different than another. Now, why speech got on the left side I don't know. There's also right-handedness and left-handedness. Mm-hmm. And whether you're right-handed or left-handed, you can still speech is still mostly on the left side. But on some people, it's just a little bit, on left-handed people, it's just a little bit more likely to be on the right side. So there's some interaction. In fact, if you're stronger on the left side for one cerebral function, you may be weaker on the right side for it. And similarly, if you're stronger on the left side for some cerebral function, you may be weaker on the right side for it. I suppose it's an idea of cramming in as many different areas as you can, and you can't do all of them on both sides, so you start to put some of them more on one side than another. That's why our brains seem more asymmetrical than a chimpanzee brain.
Mm-hmm. Are these traits like handedness, for example, heritable?
Not particularly. Mm. There is a heritability component to it, but you calculate the heritability factor. What that means is the amount of variation that can be explained by genetic variation. Mm-hmm. And it's not strong. It's there, but it's not the whole answer. Handedness is more likely linked to hormonal exposure in the womb, for example. Mm-hmm. It's thought to be whether testosterone, for example, is a factor in left-handedness, it seems.
Mm-hmm. But it's not something that's learned, or is it?
You can teach people to write with their left hand, or to write with their right hand, and many countries still do this, and the U.S. maybe still does it in some place, but they probably don't anymore. Because when you write with your left hand from left to right, you tend to smudge things. So they were training everybody to write with their right hand, even if they were naturally left-handed. And you can tell when someone's left-handed, probably as early in the womb as they could start to move their limbs in the womb. So you can predict when someone's going to be right-handed because they're using their right hand more in the womb, and they're sucking their right thumb. But you know, a left-handed person could be born and taught to write with their right hand and throw with their right hand, and they will eventually become right-handed or ambidextrous. So you can learn to, but it certainly helps to do it at a very young age.
Mm-hmm. So just one last question then. After all we've talked about, would you have some, let's say, take-home messages that you would like people to take from this book when it comes to brain development and perhaps some of the misconceptions that might be out there?
Yes, okay. When you talk to people about brain development and what happens in the womb, most people don't know very much at all about it. So one of the key ideas in this book was to explain how much of the brain develops in utero, so mm-hmm. that when you're born, you already have a functioning brain, you already have a brain that's particularly yours. It still has to develop, but it isn't a completely blank thing. It's already developed. It already has lots of information in it. It already has the capacity to have a particular way of dealing with the world. I guess that's the main message I'd like to get across this book, so that people understand that a lot has already happened by the time a person is born. Even though you can't see it, and a baby is born, you can see its face. Oh, he looks like his dad, or oh, she looks like her mom. But you can't say right away, oh, his brain is like his dad's, or like that. or what happened to their brain? What is their brain like? How did it develop? And if it is a certain way, how did that happen? And the other thing is, you learn a lot from studying the way the brain is built that will probably help medicine. How, if you're going to repair brains, which is still a big thing that we talked about, a grail in medicine, you probably want to understand how it was built in the first place so that you can rebuild broken parts.
Okay, so the book is again Zero to Birth, How the Human Brain is Built. I will be leaving a link to it in the description box of this interview. Dr. Harris, just before we go, would you like to tell people where they can find your work on the internet?
There's only this one popular book. The other book I've written with co-authors is a textbook of developmental neurobiology, but that's a bit heavy going if you're not a university student studying neuroscience. It's not for first year people. I've written lots of research articles, but they're very specialized too. But you can search them, certainly. You can go to my website at the University of Cambridge, and that lists publications.
So, Dr. Harris, thank you so much again for taking the time to come on the show, and it's been a real pleasure to talk to you.
And vice versa. Thank you very much.
Okay. Hi, guys. Thank you for watching this interview until the end. If you like what I'm doing and to keep the channel sustainable, please consider supporting me on Patreon or PayPal. All of the links are in the description box of this interview. Otherwise, and if you like what I'm doing, please share it, leave a like, and hit the subscription button. This show is brought to you by Enlights Learning and Development Done Differently. Check the website at enlights.com. I would also like to give a huge thank you to my main patrons and PayPal supporters, Karen Litzke and Blanchett, Perga Larsen, Lau Guerrero, Francis Ford, Hans Frederick Sunder, Ricardo Vladimiro, Craig Healy, Adam Castle, Olaf Alex, Jonathan Wiesel, Jacob Klinkby, Matthew Whittingbird, Arno Wolf, Tim Hollis, Ian Riccalania, John Connors, Paulina Barron, Philip Force Connolly, Jerry Mueller, Herbert Gintis, Rutger Voss, Wo Weingard, Rebecca Neuberger, Goldstein, Dan Demetri, Robert Windegar, Rui Narcio, Arthur Coe, Zup, Mark Neves, Colin Holbrook, Susan Pinker, Bernardo Seixas, Pablo Santurbano, Simon Columbus, Jorge Espinha, Phil Kavanagh, Corey Clark, Mark Blythe, Roberto Inguanzo, Michael Stormir, Eric Neumann, Samuel Andreev, Tiago Nunes, Bernardini, Alexander Dunbauer, Fergal Cusson, Ivan Bodrink, Paul Herzog, Don Ross, Jonathan Librand, Haslam Bullitt, Nathan Nguyen, Stanton T, Samuel Correa, Eric Hines, Mark Smith, J.W. João Oeira, Tom Hummel, David Sloan Wilson, Yasila Dez Araújo, Romain Roach, Dmitry Grigoriev, Diego Londoño Correa, Tom Roth, Yannick Punter, Adana Rusmani, Charlotte Bliss, Nicole Barbaro, Adam Hunt, Pavel Ostasevsky, Nelek Bach, Catherine and Patrick Tobin, Al Ortiz, Guy Madison, Gary G. Hellman, John Linares, Lida Cosmidis, Simon Afzal, Adrian Yeagi, Nick Golden, Paulo Tolentino, João Barbosa, Jules Price, Edward Hall, Edwin Bronner, Franca Bortolotti, Gabriel Pons Cortez, Ursula Litzke, Dennis Cook, Scott, Zachary Fish, Tim Duffy, Todd Shackelford, Sonny Smith, and John Wiseman. My producers, Cesar Webb, Jim Frank, Lucas Stafiniak, Luis Caetano, Tom Wagner, Dan Curtis Dixon, João Linhares, Benedict Mueller, Vega Guidis, Ardus Francis, Thomas Trumbull, and Nuno Welder. And my executive producers, Michel Rugieski, Rosie, James Pratt, Matthew Lavender, Sergio Quadriano, and Bogdan Canivets. Thank you for all.